books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show made in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and coming up today, we'll talk to debut novelist Kate Kemp about The Grapevine, in which there are secrets behind every closed door in the neighbourhood, and the identity of a murderer is only one of them. We'll also hear about Share the Vision, a coalition of UK organisations that work together to improve the quality, availability and accessibility of library services for visually impaired and print disabled people. And talking of accessible libraries, we'll find two brand new books in the RNIB library. All that in today's Read On. The debut novel from Kate Kemp, The Grapevine, won the 2021 Stylist Prize for Feminist Fiction in an earlier draft. Kate said she was interested in exploring women at different ages, how they inhabit their body, how they choose to present themselves. The book is set in the sweltering summer of 1979 in a quiet cul-de-sac in Canberra. The Grapevine opens with a woman scrubbing traces of blood from her bathroom floor, and we learn that her husband has killed their neighbour. The audio version of The Grapevine is read by Jennifer Vuletic.
Naomi was on her knees in the bathroom, scrubbing the yellow and white checkered tiles. In his rush to wash, Richard had been careless, dumping his clothes on the floor, leaving a dirty great blotch. From there, the odd smear and spatter spread across the floor, up the wall, against the tub, the lip of the shower. Naomi slapped the cloth into the sink, rinsed it, wrung it out. The sink was a mess too. And the grouting, would it stain? She shook some more Ajax from the tin. Naomi's mother liked to say that a woman must play the hand she is dealt. She wasn't like other mums with their pot roasts and trips to the beach and docking pocket money rather than love for simple transgressions. She always said that wasn't her fault because they weren't the cards she held. Later, when Naomi was grown up, she said the same thing. A woman must play the hand she is dealt. But now it was an accusation instead of an excuse, said with half a lip lifted, smug, triumphant, implying that Naomi played her hand poorly. How galling to prove her right. I had it coming, thought Naomi. My own damn fault for trying to change my hand.
The Grapevine is a story about the people who live on a small cul-de-sac in Canberra in 1979. And how their lives are upended when a young man is murdered. It is a murder mystery, a bit more of a why done it than a who done it. It's also a coming of age story. There's forbidden love and unrequited love, a heat wave, lots of gossip and suspicion and prejudice. At its heart, though, I think it's really about the hidden lives of women and, you know, what their chances are of reinventing themselves if they want to.
The towels, bath mat and toilet seat cover were new, a matching set, yellow freckled with brown. She wasn't meant to be buying new things for the house, but when she'd shown Richard the picture in the Kmart catalogue, held the open page against the tiles so he could see how well they'd go together, presented it with a flourish of her arm and a wiggle of her hips, he'd laughed. Go on, you should have them. He'd said, you funny little thing. They would have to be chucked out now. No matter how many times she washed them, she'd never be able to look at those flecks of brown again without wondering. As Naomi scrubbed and wiped and rinsed on repeat, she didn't rise from her knees because she didn't trust her legs to hold her. She bit hard on the inside of her cheek until she tasted blood. She wished she were a smoker. There was blood on her watch strap near the clasp. It would have to go to 3:15. Naomi was no stranger to the hours between midnight and dawn. They had become her recent companions, those hours that stretched time and distorted thought, where problems grew personalities and anxiety waged war. Usually the only accompaniment to her wakefulness was the house shifting its weight, stretching and easing itself. Now, though, she could hear Richard in the kitchen, also cleaning. She could tell that his movements were sure, efficient, unencumbered. Sweat pooled between her breasts and trickled downwards. She was wearing the satin kimono that Richard had brought back for her from Takamatsu. He always knew what to get, what she'd love. He was good that way. The kimono stuck to her skin wherever it touched. Naomi drew it tighter, hugging it around herself as she sat back on her heels. She wished she could slide out of her skin and inhabit another. Anyone else's would do. She wished she had a mum to look after her. Not her own. One who would talk to her in a soothing voice and make everything all right. She wished she weren't a mum herself.
Tell us about the evolution of this book, because it was a prize winner in 2021, won the Stylist Prize for Feminist Fiction, and at the time it was still called Wara Place. So how has it evolved since then?
That was a competition that accepted unpublished and also unfinished manuscript. So I didn't have a full manuscript. I'd been writing it for a while, mainly concentrating on what I could learn through the process of writing. I knew I wanted to be a writer. I knew I wanted it to be my career, even though, you know, the odds of that happening, I knew were stacked against me. But, you know, I'd trained hard for previous careers that I'd had. And so, you know, I expected that I would have to put in the hours of training if I wanted to be a writer as well. So I was sort of doing a lot of writing and then rewriting and looking at it from different angles and changing the structure and changing the form. But when I won that competition, that's when I landed my agent, Nell Andrew, who was already at that point right at the top of my list of dream agents. It was wonderful. It felt like having reached a longed for destination, as well as, you know, embarking on something new. And I was also terrified because I didn't know if I had it in me to finish a book, but it was brilliant to have somebody to bounce ideas off, to tell me in a very straightforward way what worked and what didn't work. And, you know, I really enjoyed having somebody to say, look, you know, when can you get me the next bit? And, you know, when do you think we're going to be finished? Because it just meant that, you know, I was working much more to a schedule and had somebody else believing in me and, you know, thinking I could do it. And when she felt it was ready to go, it almost felt like she had to sort of prize it away from me. And I wonder if, you know, if that hadn't happened, if I would still be tinkering away with an unfinished manuscript all these years later. But from that point, she sent it out and it went to auction. And I absolutely loved that part of the process because, you know, at that point, unless something went terribly wrong, it was pretty sure that it was going to get a publisher. And so I got to meet people who had immense expertise and experience, and they all had ideas about the book and what would make it work better and how it could be positioned. And so, you know, I just lapped that up. It was lovely having those conversations.
Now, you're based in the UK now, but did you live on a street like Wara Place?
I did. I lived on a street, not exactly the same, but fairly similar, between the ages of 5 and 10. My family lived in Canberra at that stage. And that's, you know, why I set the book there is, you know, when the idea came to me, I just had surgery. I had risk reducing surgery because of a family history of breast and ovarian cancer. And, you know, I was thinking a lot about my mum and wishing I could talk with her, you know, thinking about what her life was like when she was the age that I was, and just wishing I could ask her lots of questions about all the different things that tugged at what it meant to be a woman back then, and, you know, what it might be like for other women around her, not just her, but, you know, women who experienced life in a different way or had different backgrounds. So that was sort of the inspiration for the story, just wanting to have a bit of a chat with my mum and going back to that place where we lived as a family.
There's no spoilers here, but the book does open with a woman at 3 in the morning cleaning up someone else's murder. Do you think that was the woman's place at the time?
Well, that's the line that appears on the first page, isn't it? That, a woman must play the hand she is dealt. And I think the rest of the book is pretty much me going, well, really, let's have a bit of a think about that. And if a woman does want to change her life, where are the opportunities for her to do that? And what are the constraints? And how might it be different for different women? I'm very interested in thinking about women who occupy spaces where gender intersects with race or age or class or mental health or sexual orientation, that, all of these things embed us within power structures. And for some of us, those power structures are a tailwind and open doors, and for others, it's a headwind and the doors slam in your face. So I just wanted to really sort of tease apart just what might be possible. How do we construct those spaces that are available to some women? Are there ways that, together we can create new spaces and be more inclusive?
I'll just say, as a non-Antipodean reader, it confused me slightly that the book was set in the height of summer, but of course it's Christmas time in Australia. We've got different
Yeah,
seasons.
you're not the only one.
Ants are social beings. They live in groups, which makes sense because on their own they are small and the world is big and full of danger. They work together because of evolution, for the survival of the group, nothing to do with liking each other or being nice. The queen has all the babies, masses of them. The rest of the females do everything else. Make the nest, get food, look after the littlies, detect danger, and fight enemies. The males have two purposes, mating and dying. The collective noun for ants is colony, which is pretty boring as far as collective nouns go, but that's not their fault. Correction, there are other collective nouns: army, Soviet, swarm, state, nest, bike.
Now, I'd Australian writer Charlotte Wood on a few weeks back talking about Stoneyard Devotional, and her
Oh, I
book
adore
has
that book.
well, her book has mice crawling in the background, but your book has ants. Were ants a big feature in Wara Place?
I have memories of, my sister and I when we were kids in summer watching trails of ants crawl along, concrete and disappear into cracks and so forth. But, when I was writing this, a lot of it was during the pandemic where I couldn't get back to Australia, even if I wanted to. And I suddenly felt very nostalgic for, so many things that are a part of Australian life, particularly the natural world in Australia, the insects and animals and trees and all the different sorts of plants and native plant life that there is over there, and the landscape and how space feels very different there, and the light has a different quality to it. So I think, the ants for me were a handy narrative device for that. There's a 12-year-old girl who's really trying to understand how the community works, and she uses the ants and the way they behave as a way of trying to understand that. But I think it was also me connecting with what it's like to be in an Australian summer outside and, seeing the insect life around you.
Was it hard to picture that when you were stuck in a rainy UK, that just the heat of Australia?
I delighted in it, actually. I immersed myself in, reading lots of reference books. I read lots of first-hand accounts of living through the 1970s, as well as, what it was like to be an immigrant in Australia. And I looked at loads of photographs and listened to people speaking about their experiences, and I interviewed people. I think being away from it, I had to very much delve into my own memories, and I sent endless emails to my dad to rummage around in his memory as well. And my sister was really helpful. I was constantly WhatsApping her and say, in Australia, what do we call the corner shop? Or, just trying to get my memory straight about what belonged to Australia and what belonged to the UK.
Now, we heard at the start of this interview a clip of the audio version of the book read by Jennifer Viletic. Did you have any hand in the choosing of her as the narrator?
I did. I was sent quite a lot of submissions of people doing samples of readings. In fact, we went through a couple of rounds of submissions. The tricky thing was to find somebody who could do the different accents. So as well as, the Australian residents, you've also got a couple who were from Croatia and a family from Hong Kong and another family from Italy. And it felt really important to me to be able to get those accents right and in a way that weren't exaggerated and tipping over into caricature. And when I heard Jennifer's submission, I thought, oh, we've got it. We've got it. And then, sort of, the more I listened to her, I also felt there was something about her general tone, because there's an element of humour at places in the book, but I never wanted it to feel like the narrative voice, either in the book or in the audio book, was making fun of the characters. And I just felt like her tone was one of coming to the work and to the characters with respect and empathy. And so I've just recently been sent the files of the whole audio book, and I've listened to enough of it now to just feel really, really glad that Jennifer submitted and she was available to do it. And I think she's brilliant.
Do you not fancy having a go at doing it yourself?
Gosh, no. I'm completely rubbish at accents. I would totally make a hash of that. And I think narrating in general is quite a skill. I don't think I've got the acting chops to pull it off, really. So, I'm very, very happy to leave that to someone who knows what they're doing.
Do you listen to audiobooks yourself?
I do now. In fact, there was a time a couple of years ago, I had a thyroid illness that, for quite some months, it really interfered with my concentration and made me feel incredibly agitated. And I had a tremor in my hands and just found reading to be quite impossible. And it bothered me immensely. And I found that the only way to calm my body and my mind was to give my hands something to do. And so I started knitting. And that was the gateway then into listening to audiobooks. And I was just so grateful to be able to access stories again. And, I've continued that. I do read physical books, but I always have an audiobook on the go as well, and I love it.
You'll know this firsthand, then. It's the book is now accessible to anyone for whatever reason, be it sight loss, dyslexia, doesn't have a relationship with print, so that's important to you.
Oh, yeah, no question. Absolutely. Nobody should be denied access to stories. And I think of books as a conversation. This book that I've written is not me just parceling up a set of ideas and handing it over with a big full stop at the end of it. It's an invitation. I thought really carefully about how these ideas were presented through the characters' lives and what happens to them and what choices they make and what the themes were. And I really wanted there to be enough space for people to bring their own thoughts and reflections and experiences to those ideas as well. And I'm not interested in anybody being left out of that process. That's not on. I'm not having it. So, I want that to be available for anyone who wants to respond to the work or to think about the work in any way that fits for them to be able to.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the audio version from RNIB is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of the book?
Sure. I got my final copy just yesterday, actually. A really lovely moment to be able to hold it myself. So the cover, the whole of the cover is a background of a wallpaper print of grapevines in shades of green. And in front of the wallpaper, there's a large image of a 1970s style phone receiver that's been left hanging off the hook. The phone is bright orange. It has a retro feel. And there's also a bit of an ominous feel because it's been left dangling, like something has happened abruptly to whoever was on the phone. And the title is in big letters, cream coloured across the front in the middle. And my name's down the bottom. There are some lovely quotes from lovely authors, Marion Keyes, Jenny Godfrey, and Janice Hallett in corners. And in the top right corner, there's a bright light as if the sun is shining from that direction. I love it. The designer is just Heart, and I think she has done a brilliant job. And I feel like the luckiest author in the world to have something that, to my mind, is striking as well as beautiful.
A noise on the roof, possibly in the guttering, something scampering, startled her, and she looked towards the window, even though the blind was down and the curtains drawn. Birds? A possum? Maybe that wretched cat from across the road. When she turned back, Richard was standing in the doorway. "Stop crying," he said. "It's not fair." He didn't sound angry anymore. Just determined. "Colin?" Her voice was hoarse. So was his. "He's gone back to sleep. Don't worry. He won't talk." As if that was her biggest worry. The strip lighting brought Richard's face into sharp relief. There was a trace of blood in the stubble under his chin, another in the curl of his ear. He'd have to shower again, shave. Richard reached behind him and picked up a duffel bag. He held it gingerly at a distance, his muscles working hard to maintain his posture. His face blanched. "What's that?" said Naomi. "It's not..." She felt her centre of gravity slip. "I'm dealing with it," said Richard. "I said I would. I'll cover some ground. The hills and the plaza, then go back and check at the church again, and the creek. Stop worrying, and stop that whining noise. I'll be back before it's light. We'll go to church in the morning, all of us together, like everything's normal." Naomi turned her face to the wall. She closed her eyes. The cold of the tile against her cheek and counting her jagged breaths steadied her. Colin hadn't gone back to sleep. When she opened her eyes, he was standing where Richard had been moments before, half the height of his dad. He was wearing his Roadrunner undies, looking at the bathroom with wide, marsupial eyes. "Mum," he said. "It's all right, darling." Darling wasn't a word she normally used. It felt like talking with someone else's voice. Colin wouldn't look her in the eye. He stared at her knees, at the crossed indentations left by the tiles. "Everything will be all right." But it wasn't all right. Nothing would ever be all right again. Not now that Antonio Marietti was dead.
The Grapevine by Kate Kemp is available now in print, as an e-book, and in audio, as read by Jennifer Viletic. Available wherever you buy your audiobooks. And Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's been lovely to talk with you.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And Kate will be back at the end of today's show with the books of your life. Still to come, we'll hear from Share the Vision, a coalition of UK organisations working to improve libraries for visually impaired people. And talking of which, let's find two brand new books in the RNIB library.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems. The Story of England by Dan Snow was recently given to us by Hodder.
The English cannot escape their history. We commute in the shadow of towering cathedrals and of castles that still dominate skylines. We drive on roads that follow Roman routes. We travel across Victorian bridges and viaducts. We dog walk by Georgian canals. Every weekend, more of us visit stately homes, battlefields, and other heritage sites than attend football matches. Heritage is a national hobby. When we go abroad, we absorb mostly light-hearted jibes about forts overlooking the beach that were destroyed by the Royal Navy. We are chided for treasures looted. We listen politely as heroes of our grandparents' schooling are decried as villains. We fend off questions from people obsessed by our ruling family, invariably described as English, despite being drawn as much from Scotland and the continent as England.
From battlefields, cathedrals and museums, to castles and stately homes, from the Lancastrians and Yorkists to the Roundheads and the Royalists, the history of our island nation unravels its rich tapestry beneath our very feet. Take, for instance, the Tower of London, which housed a royal menagerie featuring lions, an African elephant, and even a polar bear, some 300 years before it bore witness to Anne Boleyn's final jest with her executioner. Or the Liverpool Docks, which in the 19th century handled a whopping 9% of global trade. Or indeed the atomic weapons base at Orford Ness, which was used to secretly test nuclear weapons during the most heated periods of the Cold War. It's a tale of how our ancestors overcame, cooperated, and shaped this country to their liking, affecting our landscape, our character, our language, industries, laws, religions, and settlements with each passing century. It's a tale of how England came to be how it is today.
We move through a world that speaks our language and plays our sports. There are parliaments with speakers and political parties on every continent. It is entirely natural to stumble across familiar place names in unfamiliar surroundings. Wellington and Marlborough in New Zealand, Chipping Norton, Paddington and Sheffield in Australia, and Birmingham, Boston, New York and, of course, New England itself in the USA. Magna Carta is displayed with great reverence in Canberra and Washington, D.C. Prayers are said for the health of the king every Sunday across the globe to the most observant of the over 100 million people who identify as members of the Church of England. English history is complex. It extends far beyond our current borders. It has no neat end nor a beginning. Today, England has a football team, but not a nation state. We boast of our parliamentary tradition, yet England is a country with no parliament. It has not existed as a sovereign state for over 300 years, yet it feels alive. Millions of its inhabitants still identify predominantly as English. England's beginning is diffuse. So too is its end. There was no champagne smash on the bowels of England, no proclamation that brought it into existence. It was a generational project forged in war. A combination of the vision of a few, the luck of battle, a fortuitous run of competent kings and one particular queen, and demographics. The catastrophic arrival of the Northmen, seaborne Vikings, obliterated nearly all the long-standing, loosely English kingdoms. The crushing of the English made way for England.
The Story of England by Dan Snow is read by Tristan Hughes and runs for 9 hours and 34 minutes.
For those who like Second World War history, we have The Traitor of Arnhem by Robert Verkaik, which was given to us by Welbeck.
This is a story you will tell your grandchildren. Lieutenant General Brian Horrocks cannot have known how prophetic his words were as he briefed his tank commanders on the eve of what remains to this day the biggest combined ground and airborne operation ever undertaken. If successful, it promised to end the war by Christmas and allow victorious British and American troops to enter Berlin while the rapidly advancing Red Army was still hundreds of miles to the east. On the 17th of September 1944, the British armoured divisions of 30 Corps, commanded by Horrocks, would punch a hole through the German defences on the Belgian-Dutch border and drive like hell along Highway 69 all the way to Arnhem, the last bridge across the Rhine, and the final major obstacle to Berlin and the heart of Nazi Germany.
The end of the Second World War is in sight. Following the overwhelming victory on D-Day, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin all seek to shape the global future to their own ends and win the race to Berlin. The British launch Operation Market Garden, the greatest airborne operation the world has ever seen. It's a bold roll of the dice which, if successful, will end the war in weeks. But behind the scenes, spies are working and plans are betrayed. The operation fails and thousands of Allied soldiers die. The Traitor of Arnhem tells a never-before-told story of this iconic operation and of the very different figures working in secret to cause the catastrophic defeat. One traitor, a terrifying giant of a man, a supposed hero of the resistance who set hundreds of fellow freedom fighters to torture and death. The other, an aristocrat and an English gentleman working from inside the heart of the Allied war effort in London. Both of them working for the Russians. Drawn from unseen records and shedding fresh light on the operation and spies responsible for its failure, this is an incredible account of the battle that would go on to shape the 20th century.
The British tanks had just 48 hours to cover the 64 miles and link up with the 10,000 men of the British 1st Airborne Division, who were to be landed by glider and parachute around the town of Arnhem. Along the way, another 25,000 American paratroopers would capture 9 bridges between Eindhoven and Nijmegen, smoothing 30 Corps' path to their final objective. At 2 p.m., 350 British guns unleashed a mighty artillery bombardment on enemy positions. Half an hour later, Horrocks gave the order for the tanks of the Irish Guards to start the charge up the main road towards their first main objective, Eindhoven. The Shermans rolled forward. Field Marshal Bernard Montgomery's daring plan to outflank the Siegfried Line, capture the Ruhr, and win the race to Berlin appeared to have started well. Operation Market Garden was underway. Then, without warning, after just half an hour's advance, the well-dug-in and carefully camouflaged anti-tank weapons of Kampfgruppe Walter, a unit cobbled together from Wehrmacht, SS and Luftwaffe units commanded by Oberst Erich Walter, ripped into Horrocks' column from their position in the trees and halted its advance almost as soon as it had begun. Horrocks called in the Typhoons of the RAF to clear the Germans from the trees, but by then 9 British tanks were burning wrecks blocking the road. The supposedly lightning British advance was in trouble before it had even started. 21st Army Group's official report on Operation Market Garden read, "Anti-tank guns and Spandaus let the leading squadrons through and brewed up 8 tanks of the 2nd Squadron. The enemy positions had been much stronger than expected, and the Guards Armoured Division had to fight savagely to effect their breakout from the bridgehead established over the Meuse-Escaut Canal." Tellingly, the report also noted that among the defenders were 2 battalions of the 9th SS Panzer Division, a battle-hardened enemy force that was not supposed to be anywhere near Eindhoven.
The Traitor of Arnhem by Robert Verkaik is narrated by Jonathan Keeble and runs for 10 hours and 25 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
Thanks, Lynn. We'll be finding out about making physical libraries accessible to blind and partially sighted people with Share the Vision after this.
This is an RNIB Talking Book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. The first talking books to be sent to listeners were on LPs made of shellac.
A shellac is like a very thick plastic, and you know, if you drop them, they just shattered, basically. The average length book, let's say 10, 12 hours, so you're talking 10, 15 discs, perhaps. They were stored in very durable boxes with large straps going around them. And those durable boxes held these discs and were sent out by post in the same sort of way as we do now, of course.
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, online forums, and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Share the Vision are an organisation who are promoting library services to VI people and encouraging accessibility in libraries. I'm joined by manager Simon Savage and chair of Share the Vision, Mark McCree. Now, Mark, tell us more. What is Share the Vision?
Well, Share the Vision has been around since 1989. It was a partnership set up back in the day, as you've said, to support blind and partially sighted people accessing their local library services and to encourage the development of library provision in this area. So it's been around for quite a while. The landscape has changed a fair amount in that time in terms of reading formats, in terms of the way people access the library services, in terms of the organisations that feed into Share the Vision. Because ultimately, Share the Vision is a partnership. So charities such as RNIB, Calibre, Clear Vision, National Library, organisations such as the British Library and Libraries Connected and the Scottish Libraries and Information Council. There's lots of people who meet four times a year, sharing and pooling their ideas and focusing, as I say, on trying to improve services for VI people.
And this is across all nations in the UK.
It is, yeah, really proud to say. And there's some amazing work going on in Northern Ireland and in Scotland. And yeah, so we really benefit from having that pan-UK perspective.
Simon, tell us about the Share the Vision Challenge.
Yeah, so the Share the Vision Challenge is going to be filmed so that you can watch it on YouTube and listen to it on YouTube as well, and sort of be a bit of a mixture of a vodcast and a podcast, I think is what all the cool kids are calling it now. But it's basically going to be a challenge where I'm going to be going to all four nations and joining library staff and taking part in a challenge that shows the accessibility, but also the challenges in a honest but like positive way of like how libraries are there for their users. And yeah, it's going to be very exciting. I don't know what the tasks are, so I can't say too much because I've not been allowed to know too much, because if I have too much from advantage, that's not going to be fair. But yeah, so we're going to be heading to Bath, Swansea, Belfast and Orkney, and I'm really, really excited for it because I think it's going to be incredible to kind of gain more insight and knowledge around how libraries are accessible for people with visual impairments. But also we're really keen to look at how library staff liaise with that audience is a really big part of it as well. So it's going to be kind of a accessibility but also information awareness building project, but all a lot of fun. We don't want it to be dry, we want it to be lots of fun, possibly mildly chaotic.
Now, we've heard, talking of chaos, we've heard about Make a Noise in Libraries, Mark, and I believe that's called Hi-Viz. Is that under the Share the Vision umbrella?
It is indeed, yes. Yeah, it's one of the things I'm proudest of. So back in Make a Noise in Libraries time, it was more of a campaigning thing. So these days we're really aiming more at celebrating and just shining a light on all of the brilliant work that happens in libraries. So we changed it for that reason, to Hi-Vis Fortnight. It's the first 2 weeks in June. And really, it just gives us a chance to champion all the fantastic work that is going on in libraries. As I say, Share the Vision largely is there to support people who work in library services and to focus on improving the quality, the availability and accessibility of library services. But obviously, everyone working in library services absolutely are there for their customers. So we want to make sure that VIA customers have the best experience and that we raise awareness of all of the amazing stuff that is going on in local libraries and that VIA people can access for free. You know, it's really important that library services are free at the point of access, regardless of what format you're reading or what needs you have. So, yeah, that's one of the things we focus on most. And Hi-Vis Fortnight gives us an amazing opportunity to share those stories because customers with lived experience, you know, when Simon does his challenge, he'll be meeting various people along the way with lived experience and getting to listen to that. And we'll really benefit from having those stories.
Now, both of you must have traveled to many local libraries. That's a question for both of you. What's one thing you've seen in a library you think every library should have that makes it much more accessible?
The warm welcome is one of the most important things, really. And I think in terms of coming into a library, having the confidence, both from a customer point of view and from a staff member's point of view, you know, I think the most wonderful thing that public libraries do is that they have empathetic staff who give that warm welcome and want to help you and want to get the best for you. So not being judgmental, listening to what your needs are and finding the best book in the right format or the best activity or whatever that customer wants. I think that's the amazing stuff I see in pretty much every single public library that I go into.
I would agree with that. I think, not to steal Mark's answer, but I do think that warm welcome is the most important thing because it is that initial moment of you going into a library. And libraries can be quite daunting sometimes. So I think the other one, though, is accessibility to information of all kinds. I think, you know, having that, you know, that's something, information is something that we should all have. It's a statutory right that we get it. So I think the library being a place where you can find it in all different formats for all different walks of life, whether it be books, whether it be news, whether it be anything, again, with that warm welcome, I just think libraries are incredible spaces. But it's really hard when you ask that question. There's so many things about libraries that I've seen, having been to many, thankfully, that are amazing. And that's the other reason that we want to really hear from people about the amazing experiences that they've had in libraries, because with the sort of plans that we've got for content for Share the Vision going forward, like Mark said, it is librarian focused, but without hearing from users about the amazing things that they've experienced in libraries that other libraries can learn from. One of the things that I really love about the sector, probably more than any sector I've ever worked in, is it isn't competitive. It's about sharing knowledge, sharing information, sharing learning, and it to the betterment of everyone. So I think, yeah, that warm welcome and that information and sharing of learning. There we go. I've hit three. I cheated.
And I would just add one more of those, really. It's about sharing of resources. You know, ultimately, whether you're reading large print or a talking book or e-audio or an e-book, all of that content is available free to people with a sight impairment. So I think, especially in this day and age, people have got loads of things to spend their money on. And the fact that through their local library service, they can access information and books and reading without having to, you know, worry about finance, I think is another amazing positive.
And Simon, how can listeners get involved?
Well, we'd love to hear from them. Now, it's actually Mark that will know the email address because he's way more well-versed in everything Share the Vision than me. But if you look for us on X, we are reading site there. Also, we have a Blue Sky now because we're very ahead of the trend, where you can find us at Share the Vision as well. But Mark has some more details if you want to drop us an email.
Yes, we have a website, which is a one-stop shop for everyone working in libraries to support them, and it's reading site. So reading as in reading, site as in vision, all one word, readingsite.org.uk. readingsite.org.uk. And if anyone wants to email us, it's info@readingsite.org.uk.
Mark McCree and Simon Savage from Share the Vision, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
And finally, on today's show, a return to Kate Kemp for the books of her life. Was there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
This one, it could be a lot, but I'm going to go with Playing Beatty Bow by Ruth Park. This one was published in 1980, has a main character called Abigail, a teenage girl who's at odds with her family and with her peers and also with her own body and emotions. It's a time travel book, and as a child, it affected me in the same kind of way that the Narnia books did. Sort of, I was always teetering on the edge of believing I could travel to another world or another time. But this one is set in Australia, in Sydney. So it felt like it was much closer to home and about characters who were more like me. And it just opened my eyes to how books could be, you know, fantastical and full of magic and be transporting, as well as speak to the realities of what it meant to be young and trying to find your place in the world. I think it was really lovely, and it was one that I returned to over and over again as a kid.
In the first place, Abigail Kirk wasn't Abigail at all. She'd been christened Lynette. Her mother apologised. It must have been the anaesthetic. I felt as tight as a tick for days. And Daddy was so thrilled to have a daughter that he wouldn't have minded if I called you Ophelia. So for the first 10 years of her life, she was Linny Kirk, and happy as a lark. A hot-headed rag of a child, she vibrated with devotion for many things and people, including her parents. She loved her mother, but her father was king. When he said goodbye to her, before he went off with another lady, she was outraged to the point of speechlessness. But he could like someone so much better than herself that he didn't want to live in the same house with her any more. "I'll come and see you often, Linny. I promise I shall," he'd said. And she, who couldn't bear to see a puppy slapped or a cockroach trodden on, hit him hard on the nose. She'd never forgotten his shocked eyes above the blood-stained handkerchief. Very blue eyes they were, for he was half Norwegian. Later, she commanded her mother, "Don't ever call me Linny again, or any of those other names either." Kathy Kirk knew that her daughter was referring to the many pet names her father called her, for she was very dear to him. Because she was a loving woman, she'd put her arms round the little girl and said, "You don't understand, because you're too young yet. Just because Daddy wants to go away from me doesn't mean that he doesn't love you. But of course, you may change your name if you wish. What would you like to be called?" Weeks and months went past, and the person who'd once been Lynette Kirk had no name at all. She wouldn't answer to Lynette at home or at school. There were some puzzled notes from her teacher, which fortunately never had to be answered, because soon after the marriage breakup, Kathy Kirk sold the family home and moved into a unit her husband had given her. Her daughter was enraged that Kathy had accepted it. It was the finest in a high-rise tower her father's firm had designed, a glistening spike of steel and glass jammed in the sandstone amongst the tiny meek cottages and old bond stores of that part of Sydney called the Rocks. "You ought to be prouder," she yelled in her passion and grief. "I'd rather live in the ladies on the quay than in something he gave me." "Be quiet," said Grandmother in her razor-blade voice. "You," shouted that long-ago child, "you're glad he's gone. I know." Because she was right, this was what began Abigail's and her grandmother's silent agreement not to like each other. Yet strangely, it was through grandmother that the ex-Lynette at last found her name.
Playing Beattie Bow by Ruth Park is available in the RNIB library as read by Richard Earthy. It's also available commercially as read by Kate Hood. And is there a book on a rainy day you could happily curl up with and reread?
I have to choose Still Life by Sarah Winman for this. I love this book. It's a very expansive book. It travels over several decades and is partly set in London's East End and partly in Tuscany. And it's just so beautifully written, you know, not flowery or wordy, but it's just particular in voice and style. And it's the kind of book that comes to mind when I think about literature being an art form. And, you know, it's one I often pick it up off my shelf and I can open it at any point in the story and instantly feel delighted and replenished and nourished in the way that really good creative works, you know, fill you up.
Somewhere in the Tuscan hills, two English spinsters, Evelyn Skinner and a Margaret someone, were eating a late lunch on the terrace of a modest albergo. It was the 2nd of August, a beautiful summer's day, if only you could forget there was a war on. One sat in shade, the other in light, due to the angle of the sun and the vine-strewn trellis overhead. They were served a reduced menu, but celebrated the Allied advance with large glasses of Chianti. Overhead, a low-flying bomber cast them momentarily in shadow. They picked up their binoculars and studied the markings. "Ours," they said, and waved. "This rabbit's delicious," said Evelyn, and she caught the eye of the proprietor, who was smoking by the doorway. She said, "Coniglio buonissimo, signore." The signore put his cigarette in his mouth and raised his arm. Part salute, part wave. One couldn't be sure.
"Do you think he's a fascist?" said Margaret quietly.
"No, I don't think so," said Evelyn. "Although Italians are quite indecisive politically, always have been.
I heard they're shooting them now, the fascists."
"Everyone's shooting everyone," said Evelyn.
A shell screamed to their right and exploded on a distant hill, uprooting a cluster of small cypress trees.
"One of theirs," said Margaret,
and she held onto the table to protect her camera and wine glass from the shock waves.
"I heard they found the Botticelli," said Evelyn.
"Which one?"
said Margaret.
"Primavera."
"Oh, thank God," said Margaret.
"And Giotto's Madonna from the Uffizi, Rubens, nymphs and satires, and one more."
Evelyn thought hard.
"Ah, yes," she said. "Supper at Emmaus.
The Pontormo. Any news about his deposition?"
"No, not yet," said Evelyn, pulling a small bone from her mouth.
Still Life by Sarah Winman is available both commercially and from RNIB Talking Books, as read by the author. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
This is a book I'd really like to press into the hands of lots of people, because I think it would have wide appeal. It's I'm New Here by Ian Russell Shea. This one is about a Taiwanese British man in his 20s at a crossroad in his life. He's been dumped by his girlfriend, he's lost his job, and he goes to Taiwan not so much to find himself as to try to lose himself in boozy nights out and sexual encounters. And he ends up getting caught up in extraordinary experiences where, you know, the edges of reality and identity get blurred and start to unravel until he's pretty much confronted with the bare bones of who he is. The writing style here is very clean, very precise. Every word counts, and I just think it's extremely clever and a really good read.
I wake up alone. The TV is on at low volume. My tongue is a fat, dried slug, and a million tiny devils are busting into my skull with teeny-weeny hammers and teeny-weeny chisels. I open my eyes and push myself upright. Dull light through closed curtains. I look down, naked from the waist up. Why are my trousers damp? I smell old sweat and the vinegar reek of sick. My phone says 9:48 a.m. I close my eyes and I lie back down and I remember where I am. Breakfast. I grab my t-shirt from the floor and run out the room. Weird tasting tea. Congealed eggs, rubbery sausages, shriveled tomatoes and soggy toast. Classic budget hotel breakfast. The kind of hotel businessmen check into for somewhere cheap and clean. I don't remember getting back here last night. I do remember going to a club. What was the name? Continuum. I need to go back to bed. Someone is at my table. One of the hotel staff, arms folded. She's dressed in a navy blue skirt and a wrinkle-free white blouse, hair tied up in a bun. I look at her blankly. What are you doing here? She says in English. American-tinted English, like most Taiwanese. Her face crumples. And what is that smell? I look down at my trousers, then my food. Breakfast, I say. She says, and how is it? Not great, I say. You should tell management. Her eyes become slits. You really don't remember me, do you?
I'm New Here by Ian Russell Shea is available in audio commercially, as read by the author. And once again, Kate Kemp, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert. It's been lovely.
That's all we've got time for on today's show. We'll be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, this and over 400 other episodes of Read On are available to download as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. But remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB Library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.